The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Good afternoon on this Thursday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Yeah, loads of Christmassy type things came into ray@rte.ie. Hi Ray, you might find this one interesting. Yesterday afternoon I went to buy a Christmas tree in a DIY shop near my house. I know I should buy a charity one, but I have little children and it's a busy time of the year and I was in there buying my other bits and saw them. Anyway, they were priced at €17.99. Yes, €17.99 for about a 7 foot tree with a big bushy belly. I asked the nice young man helping around the shop were they priced correctly, as it seemed very cheap for a tree. And he told me that they had to reduce the price of the Christmas trees as a number of them had been returned to them because, wait for it, they didn't smell like Christmas trees. Could you take this Christmas tree back? It doesn't smell like a Christmas tree. Happy not to have the Christmas tree smell in my house for that price. I picked up one and brought it home. But it doesn't end there. I put it straight into the holder and left it standing in our dining room and shut the door. When my sister popped by for a cup of tea yesterday evening, the first thing she said when she came through the door was, "Oh, great, you finally put up your Christmas tree," because she could smell it, Ray. It's either a Christmas miracle or I got myself a bargain. That's brilliant, isn't it? $17.99 for a real Christmas tree. He said it didn't smell. You said, well, your sister said it did. Do you know what happens as you get older? I don't know what age the shop assistant was, but as you get older, your sense of smell fades. It does. Your olfactory senses are the first to go. So, yeah, all those lovely smells you used to enjoy, they become a sort of a distant memory. That's great. And still on trees, we have an artificial tree for 40 years. It was made in Bray, and it's a great tree, and we treasure putting it up every year. It was made in some factory in Bray, and it's better than the Christmas trees that are made now. They don't make them like they used to, right? That's Larkin and Bray. We were talking the other day about the oldest Christmas tree in England, which was bought in Woolworths in 1920, which would make it 98 years old this Christmas. So 40 years, well, we're getting there. That's a good-looking Christmas tree. It depends what you like. And people are very fussy and finicky. And, you know, it can cause arguments, I would imagine, in the country. Like in our house, my wife is a plain white bulb woman. I prefer the flash and coloured one myself, probably because it reminds me of my childhood. And we always had flashy coloured ones. And I suppose in her childhood, I didn't ask her, but I should. It was white that didn't flash. So I told you that we got the compromise one. It's brilliant. Just with a press of a button, they can change from all white stationery to flashy colour. And that's everybody's happy. Everybody's happy nowadays. I forgot to mention Pete Shelley last week, the lead singer of the Buzzcocks. Who died. They had some great pop punk songs, if that's a description of a song. That one, Everybody's Happy Nowadays, Harmony in My Head was another one, and of course, Ever Fallen in Love with Someone, Ever Fallen in Love was their biggest hit. What's the worst date you've ever been on? Irish journalist Fiona Hyde is gathering up the worst stories of dates. She put a call out to people on social media to ask them what sort of bad dates they've had. Michelle wrote about how a guy took her to his 30th birthday party. He didn't tell her it was his 30th birthday party and proceeded to introduce her to all his friends and family, despite them having only met once before for a coffee. Keane. His name might have been Keane. Well, he definitely was Keane. And poor Jay. Jay went to the cinema to see a scary movie. At one point, I jumped and my elbow connected with his face and his nose started bleeding and he lost consciousness for 2 minutes. See, that's like something out of a comedy movie. Never got a second date for some funny reason. And Catherine, she landed on a date with someone who wasn't quite over their ex. Now, they say, don't talk about your ex on a first date. Definitely don't bring your ex on a first date. Because this is what happened to Catherine. He invited his ex-girlfriend along to make her jealous and then pretended it was an hilarious coincidence. Fancy meeting you here. They went home together. Then he messaged me. Listen to this, the gall of it. He messaged me the next day saying he'd made a mistake and he went home with the wrong woman. Yeah, that's the worst date you've ever been on. A lot of people are going out and about on Christmas do's. The Christmas do is back. Remember for a few years there, a lot of workplaces cancelled their Christmas dues. Well, they're back and it's next to impossible to get a place in a restaurant around Dublin. I would imagine it's the same all over the country. Just I don't know if this is a cautionary tale or it's an interesting fact you can share with your friends as you sit down to eat your Christmas fare. But restaurant dishes contain more calories than fast food meals, according to the BMJ, the British Medical Journal. There's a lot more sauces. Portions are probably bigger. That sort of makes sense. I'm always citing the Scandinavian countries for, you know, best international practice when it comes to parenting in particular. They're very good with childcare. They're very good with paternity and maternity leave. And I see now in Denmark, a state program enables mothers access 2 days of care to get their newborn babies healthy and ready for life. All mothers, regardless of income or social status, have access to the care to give their children an equal start to their first days. Nice, huh? So you have your hospital stay and then you come out and you have 2 days paid for by the state in a hotel. And it's one of many things that they do well in Denmark. New parents are offered a combined 52 weeks of leave, during which a mother is guaranteed 18 weeks at full pay. And you see, it's then they can choose. The dad or the mum can choose who's going to take up the other weeks from that paternity leave. People in other countries who don't have money to get access to childbirth care might not be able to offer their children the same possibilities or the best start in life, says a spokesperson. It would kind of divide society, whereas here it's for everybody. So if they gave it to one person or the other, so it's available to, that's great. We could learn a lot from that. The Daily Edge, they do some very entertaining and weird and sometimes interesting surveys. Today, they're trying to find out how many pillows you use. Now, I'm a strict one skinny pillow man, but seemingly people can use up as far as four pillows. How would you do that? How could you possibly sleep with four pillows? Anyway, Daily Edge pillow update. Two pillows, 47%, one pillow, 36%, and three pillows, 7%. So there you go. So the most popular combination is two pillows, second one pillow, and three pillows is 7%. Dawn has been on to us to tell us that her mum, Marion Slattery, is a very special person. She looks after everyone and it's her birthday. So she wanted us to say happy birthday to you. Dawn, happy birthday. And she's a big fan of Leonard Cohen. Not really a Christmassy song, but we'll play a bit of this. It's a long one. Yeah, we'll play a bit of this. No, I think it's after a song. We're going to talk to Tom. We're going to talk to Tom after a song. So we'll play this and then we'll talk to Tom after that. Leonard Cohen, 1,000 Kisses Deep. That's for Marion, who celebrates her birthday today, from her daughter, Dawn. Happy birthday, Marion. 5 on 5 on Ray at RTE.ie. On dates, I went on a date with a guy, and when it was over, he was walking me to the bus stop. And while we were standing there, his girlfriend came along, and as the bus drove off with me on it, he was getting hit by her handbag. And regarding worst date, it's the date at the end of your headstone. Live life, make a fool of yourself till you meet the love of your life, and only then, wait for your worst date. In Belarus, maternity leave is 3 years, says Frank and Leash. And seriously, where is the Swedish model of childcare a prime example? Well, I said the Scandinavian, I think. We're living in a time where governments are willing to pay and promote various types of child minding with the exclusion of providing stay-at-home parents who mind their own children full-time. Anyone or anywhere but home care, says Marion in Nace. It's a difficult one, isn't it? Because they need more people in the workforce and then they encourage women to join the workforce. Well, they did, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, and then they didn't provide suitable childcare arrangements. And you're right, you know, the ideal situation is where somebody, one parent, can stay at home. But we don't live in a perfect world. In Holland, a qualified midwife looks after you and your baby at home for a week after you leave hospital, says Brian Dermody. I remember hearing that before. That's impressive, isn't it? She comes and visits every day. On the pillow thing, I'm a pile of pillows person. A pile of pillows person am I. A bed full and a big Leonard Cohen fan as well. That's Breed, that's Nevin. I use one large square duck down pillow, which I bought while living on the continent. This means my shoulders are supported and there is no pressure on my neck. And season's greetings, just to let you know that Bob Dylan and Neil Young will play Nolan Park next July. That must be from somebody who's running that gig. Coincidentally, I just had that there. Did you ever hear this? No, there, it's playing away there. There it is, yeah. Who's got a
be this long and white?
Santa's gonna be this long and white.
Who comes round on special night?
Santa comes round on special night.
Special night,
be this white. Must be Santa, must be Santa, must be Santa, Santa Claus.
Yep, that's Bob Dylan and must be Santa. Now, we got a handwritten letter from Elizabeth Flanagan from Carrigan Shannon, accompanied by a newspaper cutting from the Roscommon People. So the letter reads, Dear Ray, last week on your show you spoke about Armstrong's shop with the bar upstairs in Carrigan Shannon, which is now closed. Yeah, Armstrong's shop, you could buy a pair of shoes and a pint of Guinness at the same time. I enclosed page from Roscommon People with an advert for Robert Flynn's shop in Castlereagh. You can do all your Christmas shopping under one roof, meet a lovely gentleman, the owner Robert Flynn, and enjoy your show. Oh, enjoy your show. Happy Christmas. That's Elizabeth Flanagan. Well, we put a call in to Robert Flynn's, and yes, Robert Flynn is the name over the door, but the man who's running it now is Robert Flynn's son, Tom Flynn, and Tom is on the line. How are you doing, Tom?
Well, thank you. Well, indeed.
Yeah, great to talk to you.
Same here.
Yeah.
I got a fright when I heard who was looking for me.
How are things in Castlereagh?
They're fine.
Good.
They're fine.
Good. You don't get many shops like yours anymore, Tom.
Not really. No, they're fairly gone exclusive.
Yeah. I'm looking at the ad here. And
yep.
Will I just go through some of the things on offer? Yeah.
Do it yourself.
Well, you have an off-license there, so you have Napoleon brandy. And then you have the meat section, so you have home-cured bacon, sausages, all that sort of thing.
Yep.
Then you do sell Christmas trees as well. You do
sure.
The lotto. There's teas and coffees on offer. And then it gets interesting then. You have a full range of animal feeds.
Yep.
Chicken, duck, hens, bird seed in bulk, canary, budgie, wild bird, peanuts, rabbit feed, hamster, fox repellent, wild bird feeders, mothballs, and dog meal special $10.99.
Yeah, sure.
And then you go on to, I suppose the present for somebody in your life who has everything, because you sell aquariums, you sell binoculars, pipes, Swiss Army knives, indoor ladies and gents, old Moore's almanac, you sell that as well, Epsom salts for feet or bats. Goose grease. What's goose grease for, Tom?
Rubbing on joints, painful joints.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah,
right.
Sure, arthritis and what you will.
Ah, so it's medicinal.
It's just medicinal, sure.
Right, I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
Because I used the goose fat for the roast potatoes on Christmas Day. You know, you couldn't afford to do it every day.
Well, probably the same thing, you know.
Probably the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, basically.
The same thing. Yeah. And you do shotguns and rifles and air rifles.
That's right.
And then I'm looking at a picture of the outside of the shop. And it says here, fax and photocopying services, key cutting specialities, shoe repair services, beekeeping equipment.
That's right, with full range of that.
And do you have bees yourself?
I have about 8 hives of them.
Right, and where are they?
They're down in the garden at the back. We have about a quarter an acre of a garden down back.
Right. Can I just say, looking at the picture, it's a very tidy shop you run there.
Well, no, she likes to think that sometimes we think the opposite, but...
Right.
Yeah, sure.
And how would you describe the shop? You know, is it a grocer's or
it could be, you know, like an old-time grocer's. There used to be a pub at the back.
Yes.
But we got rid of the pub at the back and we put an off-license inside the door as we go in.
Yes. And would there have been a saloon-type door into the pub at the back?
It would be that.
Yes, yeah.
Initially.
Yeah. There was a place like that in Kildare called Nolan's.
Sure.
Yeah, and they used to call it... What did they call it? They used to call it Lourdes, I think, or Knock, one of the places, because you could get a cure first thing in the morning. That was
sure.
The...
I understand. Sure, Before pub hours.
Exactly, before pub hours, yeah.
Yeah,
What's the best seller at the moment, Tom?
Well, a good question. Everything to an extent. No, the Christmas trees and holly and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you do fake and real?
Say,
Christmas trees, fake and real Christmas trees.
We do, both, yeah, sure.
Both, right, okay, yeah. And how long have you been in business?
Well, my father opened in Boyle in 1928, that's 90 years ago.
Yeah.
And he moved to Castlereagh in 1945. He worked in Castlereagh, or at least in Castlereagh as a young lad when he came into town, maybe about 1910 or 1912. And he opened himself in Boyle in 1928, from the 28 to 1945.
And then...
And from 1945, he died in 1965. And I had to move in after that.
And what age were you in 1965?
27.
Right. Okay. So, will I do the maths on that then?
No. No. No, we'll leave that to your listeners.
Yeah. Do you do wrapping paper?
We do, yeah, sure.
Do you ever get frustrated if somebody comes in asking for something you don't have, Tom?
I would sometimes I tell you to come in and ask maybe not ridiculous thing.
Like what?
Well, good question.
Might be
a part for a care or something like that, or something that's totally out of our focus.
Yes, you don't do that. You don't do electronic equipment, I would imagine.
No, not really. No. Yeah. We do bulbs and holders and that sort of thing.
Would you have a plug?
Oh, we would, sure.
Yeah.
And a 3-pin plug or a 3-pin holder and all the rest of it. We have all those things, bits and pieces.
How do you keep track of all the stock?
Well, you do it without thinking.
Do you?
Yeah, sure. You don't have to think at all when you're with it, like, and you're stuck in it. You don't have to think at all.
Of course, you've been doing it so long.
Well, we've been doing it so long, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Who runs the shop with you?
Myself and my sister, and we've two men working for us.
Great. Great. And what's your arrangement over Christmas now? Will you stay open till Christmas Eve?
Till Christmas Eve night we close, and just close for Christmas Day, and we open for a few hours Stephen's Day.
Right.
And after that.
Right. Wasn't that famously when Michael O'Leary ran a shop in Dublin, the Ryanair man?
Yeah.
He was one of the first in the area to open on Christmas Day because he realised that there was a demand for batteries.
Oh, I could copy that from him.
Yes, you could copy that from him because
I could copy that from batteries on Christmas Day.
You could just advertise that he'd be open for a half hour or something like that. You know,
I understand usually after the midday mass.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Well, listen, Tom, it's great. Great talking to you. Wait, now they're telling me there's a text on top here about you. I don't know what's going to say. It was Murphy's Pub in Kildare that they used to call the Vatican. Oh, yeah. Well, it was Nolan's that they used to call Lourdes. That's nothing to do with you. That's not a shop. It's a mall. Season's greeting, Angela Nolan's is in Fianna. She's saying you're a shopping centre, Tom, not a shop. You're a shopping centre, not a shop.
Well, thank you for the compliment.
Well, listen, great talking to you. And the half page ad is in there in the Roscommon People for everything on offer there, from binoculars to brandy and back down to goose grease. Everything is there in Tom Flynn's shop in Castlereagh. Tom, happy Christmas.
And yourself.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
To you and yours.
Bye now. All at RTE. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551. Please wish my mother, Chrissy Hochter, in Nina, a very happy December birthday today. She's listening in and would love a mention. She too ran a wonderful traditional grocery shop for many years in Nina Town. That's Michelle, her daughter. And a lot of nice texts coming in about Tom Flynn from Castlereagh. And on maternity leave, we have a scheme here called Domino. Early release if you live in an area that covers it. So I had a midwife from the Coombe come to visit me at home every day till baby was 5 days old, free of charge under the public system. It's fantastic to be home in own bed with baby. And you've hit the nail on the head when it comes to childcare. I don't know. There you go. It's to get women into the workforce, not what's best for children. Children would rather be minded by their own parent. Two working parents have sent house prices sky high. It's a vicious circle and sad, says that person. And it amazes me that parents will moan about childcare costs, but they think nothing of going on two holidays and weekend breaks each year. Two cars, 5-bedroom houses, and yes, they're entitled to it, but you never hear them moaning about having to pay for luxuries, yet the most cherished people in their lives, kids, is a cause for moaning to get them cared for. And would Tom have a crankshaft for a 1964 Cortina? Eamon wants to know. And have the midwife visits at home for several days after birth here too, included under the public system. If you have a home birth, it's an air code lottery whether there is an independent midwife in your area. I hate the idea of being in a hotel away from older children and home comforts. It might be nice on a first baby if you have no food issues, if you're happy being away from home, says that person. Now, it's that time of the year, whenever you go into a shop or a supermarket or whatever, there's Christmas music been piped in, isn't there? Yes. And you'll hear what could be your favourite song or it could be the one you hate. Not everybody enjoys music being piped into shops. And Nile Rodgers is the National Secretary of Pipe Down in the UK. It's the campaign for freedom from pipe music. And Nigel is on the line. How are you doing? How are you doing, Nigel?
I'm well, thank you.
There's Nile Rodgers as well. Nigel Rodgers and Nile Rodgers. I'm sure his music has been played into shops. He was the chic man.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, we were born on exactly the same day.
Were you? Isn't that extraordinary
coincidence?
That is an extraordinary coincidence. It is indeed, yeah. Okay, so when did you start Pipe Down?
about 25 years ago.
And why did you start it?
Well, one particular incident triggered it. I was with my then-girlfriend eating in a small restaurant in West London, and it was very, very loud music all round. I asked the waiter if it could be turned down, and he said, sorry, the orders come from above, we have to have it. So then I asked all the other diners around what they thought. Not a single person liked it. So we walked out and began discussing, and we both agreed something ought to be done about it. And Emily turned to me and said, you ought to do something about it. So I find that it did. I've been hating the stuff, the way it's becoming more and more common and inescapable, ubiquitous and non-stop. So, and that's what led me to found Pipedown a long time ago now, but my goodness, we've rolled on.
Yes, you have rolled on, and you have, do you call them committees or organisations all over the world?
Yes, we have six, I think, or is it five? We've got one in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, and in Germany, and in Switzerland. And they all do their own thing because they've got particular problems, but we all subscribe to the same general idea, is that music is wonderful, but not when it's forced on you and you don't want it.
Yes. Was it that you didn't like the music that was being played in that cafe all those years ago, or was it just the fact that there was music?
I don't remember what sort of music it was, to be honest. We just couldn't hear ourselves speak or yell. I think that's the real thing. If you can't hear yourself talk, any kind of music becomes unpleasant. But the other thing is that at the approach to Christmas, they tend to play the same carols or half dozen carols or bits of Christmassy music again and again. One estimate is that Jingle Bells is played in some stores 300 times in the run-up to Christmas. That's acoustic torture for
it
you.
It is. You'd have to feel sorry for the poor shop assistants, wouldn't you?
We do, and I get a lot of letters from people working in shops and other places saying, what can we do about it? And at the moment, in Britain, there are no real laws to protect workers from that sort of sound because it's not quite loud enough. It's not over 80 decibels, which is considered physically damaging. Mm. And normally, anyway, it's not over 80 decibels. And therefore, we can't do anything about it. But we are pressing for a change of attitude. Some of the stores are beginning to wake up to it, actually, because people with autism and Asperger's and ME and similar problems find it acutely distressing. It can bring on attacks. And so some stores in Britain, like Tesco, Asda and Morrison's, have been introducing quiet hours, which is only normally 1 hour a week, sometimes only 1 hour a month, but at least they do turn everything off that 1 hour.
They've done a lot of research on the psychology of shopping, and now they even introduce smells into shops to try and encourage you to buy more. You've obviously thought about this and spoken to people and probably done a bit of research around it.
Mm.
Is there a psychology or is there any theory behind playing music in shops?
Well, there's quite a lot written on it, and some of it's been very well funded. But if you look at it closely, it's very ambiguous, and it builds on a very slender foundation. The academics who did the original research did it innocently enough, I think. And sometimes, if you play German music in a supermarket, yes, people may well think about
German beer or something,
sauerkraut, or if it's French. But it's very vague, and I always say, look, what you should do to make it, you should have a control study, and one supermarket should be playing German music while offering French food, and if all the shoppers turn their noses up at the French food and say, I want sauerkraut, then you'll know it really works, but they never do that. So I think it's pretty bogus research.
Yes. And do you have any specific opinions on Christmas music being piped into shops?
Well, yes, we think it's the worst time of the year.
Do you?
Because of what I was saying earlier,
because
of Jingle Bells.
Yes,
I mean, we managed to persuade Marks and Spencer in the UK to stop its pipe music, but alas, they do reintroduce it at Christmas, as do several of the other otherwise quiet big supermarket chains. And I know people who've worked in those supermarkets at Christmas, and they said it's a terrible noise. Mm. They're not everyone working beside them, or almost everyone, dislikes it, but no one dares put their head above the parapet because they think they might be penalised by the management.
I suppose from the management's point of view, me or you as a shopper, we're only in there for a half an hour or three quarters of an hour maximum, so we're just getting one rotation of the songs, so we're not going to hear the same song over and over again. So if I'm walking around and I'm in a Christmassy mood and I'm buying some presents and this comes on, I think to myself, I might even hum Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to myself. You know, or if this comes on.
Times we
Like, I would never normally listen to choral music, but if that came on in a shop and I was purchasing, you know, a present for my wife or something like that, it would all add to the atmosphere of Christmas.
Yeah, but if you went into the next shop, it was the same, and the next shop, yes, and then you walked down the street and you could hear it everywhere, and you went into a restaurant or a pub and you could hear it all the time, yes, you would begin to feel a bit different.
A bit nauseous.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes sickening because you, it's the fact that it goes, pipe music is hellish because it goes on all the time. It doesn't stop and you can't escape it. It's piped into every corner of a room or a building or even sometimes down a street. And you, the only way to escape it is to either stay at home or put in earplugs. But people go out to bars or pubs to talk, not to just drink or eat on their own, you know.
Well, you see, in a bar, that is, you see, you can understand from a management point of view whether it's right or wrong. If they have loud music on and they discourage you from talking, if you don't talk, what are you going to do?
Well, you can drink, but you're more likely to get out.
Yes.
If you're aged over 40, you're going to find the noise, you're likely to find the noise so irritating that you leave and spend very little there.
I've just thought, Nigel, about Christmas music. Because there is a limited amount of Christmas music, you're more likely to hear the same things over and over again. Because for the rest of the year, if I went into, say, a Gap store, they'll have a certain type of music. And then if I went to Cat Kitson or somewhere else like that, they'll have a different type of music if they have music at all. You see, but for Christmas, everybody's limited to the same palette, of, if you like, of Christmas music. So you're bound to hear this.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. With the kids' jingle bell.
Or this.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad.
Are you getting nauseous, Nigel?
Oh, God. Pass me the sick bag. Or the earplugs, anyway.
So what do we do? Do you think there should be a piped down set up in Ireland?
Oh, I think so, certainly. There was something once set up, 15 years ago, by some people called Pint. Preserve the Irish National Tavern, it was called.
Right.
And they functioned, they were just fighting for pubs, and they functioned for about a year, but I haven't heard from them, and they don't have a website or anything.
Okay,
so,
okay. Well, we'll throw it out there today. If somebody is listening and they want to set up the Campaign for Freedom from Pipe Music in Ireland, then we'll put them on to you. Ray, it used to be like the old days, listen to Atlantic 252, same songs being played every hour. Ah, the old days, says Mick and Neve. Loud music is a bane, says Rory, that's what you're saying. And supermarkets normally play depressing type music. The purpose is that customers tune into the mood and therefore are more inclined to buy in order to boost their mood. You will never hear rousing, uplifting music in a supermarket. That's an interesting theory. Nigel, listen, thanks very much for talking to us today. Hope you have a lovely Christmas.
Thank you.
See you, Nigel.
Have a quiet Christmas or a happy Christmas yourself.
Good luck. See you. Bye. We'll take a commercial break.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray@rte.ie. Now, we're doing sort of a little series on our People of the Year, and one name on everyone's lips this year was Maurice McCabe, Garda Sergeant Maurice McCabe, a whistleblower. He's endured a tortuous decade and a bit, from complaining about shoddy investigations of serious crime in Cavan in 2008 to vindication at the Charlton Tribunal in October of this year, 2018, dealing with vilification, bullying, harassment and vicious rumours that would have destroyed a lesser man. And someone who knows Maurice McCabe, I suppose better than most, is Irish Examiner Special Correspondent Mick Clifford, and he's just updated his book, a brilliant book, A Force for Justice, The Maurice McCabe Story, and Mick joins me now. Afternoon, Mick.
Hi, Ray.
So I suppose huge, vindication of Maurice McCabe and what he has done, and vindication for you as well, because you were there from early on.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, look, I was just doing a job and I was fortunate, and you meet somebody, you meet people like the McCabes, and you realise, geez, these are people of substance, and how come they're in a situation like this, you know, and basically just following the trail, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it was great for him and for his wife Lorraine and for the whole family, that kind of vindication.
So the first incident in the story happens in 2006, and it doesn't end till October this year. So that's 12 years, really, isn't it?
Yeah. That's true, yeah. I mean, we're talking about the incident, about the allegation and...
Way back, yeah. Well,
yeah. So, well, that was an incident.
We'll start at the end.
Yeah.
We'll start, the Charlton Commission of Investigation, wasn't it? Isn't that what they call
the Tribunal. Tribunal. There's the O'Higgins Commission. There's so many of them you get mixed up and all that.
Okay.
But the Tribunal is public. The Commission of Investigation is behind closed doors.
The Tribunal, and this was held in Dublin Castle, and people will be familiar with seeing the main players go across the courtyard and in. And the findings then, they completely were in Maurice McCabe's favour.
Absolutely. Judge Charlton said that he had done a considerable service to the state, which echoed what a presumed former colleague now, Judge Kevin O'Higgins, who'd be retired, he said Morris, in his commission of investigation, which inquired some of this, said Maurice McCabe had done a great service to the state. So, but this was public and this was further vindication. There was really three elements to it in terms of, and it was all to do with how what had befallen him, how he was treated in various guises. One had to do with a completely erroneous allegation that was generated in Tusla that suggested he was a suspect in very serious child sexual abuse. That was shown to be the most unbelievable series of errors. There was an initial mistake. Somebody put his name in a report by accident, the therapist, understandable on a human level. But following that, it was compounded time and time again by a number of errors all the way, went on for nearly a year. This notice went to the Gardaí. It went all the way up to the headquarters in the Gardaí, all of which suggested that he was a suspect in this serious child sexual abuse. Now, the thing, he never would have found out about it, but for the final error, which was they sent him a letter basically saying, as a standard letter would go out to somebody who would be a suspect in this scenario, saying, you know, we believe, we've reason to believe you may be a danger to children, we'd like to talk to you about it. Naturally, it floored him, sent him to a very dark place. But as a result of that, him and his legal team were able to investigate it and find out what exactly happened. All of that blew up in February 2017. I reported in the Examiner, it was reported then on prime time by Katie Hannon. That basically, I think there was real, the public were horrified that something like that could happen to somebody with a suspicion that it might have been associated with his claims of malpractice. And anyway, that was the kernel that set up the tribunal. In relation to that, the judge found that it doesn't seem that there was anybody who was out to get him, but it was quite a frightening series of errors that were involved. Frightening to the extent that it showed that a perfectly innocent person could end up in a scenario where thereby they were portrayed in that kind of manner, you know?
Because if you wrote this in fiction...
Exactly. You wouldn't,
you wouldn't believe it.
You'd reject it.
It would be rejected. Yeah. So that was the first thing. You said those three.
Yeah, the other thing, then the O'Higgins Commission, and there was, I'd reported a story based on leaks from O'Higgins, there was a case to be made whether or not there had been attempts at O'Higgins to blemish his character. O'Higgins was set up to look into the investigate to the malpractice he had claimed. He had made complaints of malpractice. It was investigated internally in the Gardaí. He was very disappointed with that investigation. He felt it wasn't proper. Eventually, through a circuitous route, Micheál Martin had a dossier of this stuff. He walked into the Dáil with it. He brought it up with Enda Kenny. Enda Kenny said it was horrific. He recommended setting up an inquiry. The outcome of that inquiry was the O'Higgins Commission. There was a case to be made whether or not there were attempts behind the closed doors of O'Higgins to blemish his character. That was investigated. Ultimately, Judge Charlton found there wasn't. But again, there was a whole series of errors. And again, none of them were in his favour. There can be an error, you can err with the bank.
Yeah.
The bank can claim they've given you too much money or they've given you too little. It's in your favour or against you. None of them were in his favour. But ultimately, it found that nobody was out to do him down specifically at O'Higgins. The third one, which was in some ways the biggest one, was there a campaign to blacken his character by associating him with child sexual abuse in the highest echelons of an Garda Síochána? That originated with the former Garda press officer, Dave Taylor. Now, the type of campaign he described, Charlton said there was not that type of campaign, but there was a campaign, and Judge Charlton implicated both Dave Taylor and the former Commissioner Martin Callanan as being responsible for that. And when you put that in context, the Commissioner of the Gardaí, Supreme Court judge, saying this man was responsible for being involved in a campaign to blacken one of his officers in the most horrendous type of character assassination because this guy was standing up and saying, there's something gone wrong here, this needs to be looked at.
Yeah, and both David Taylor and Martin Callanan have resigned.
Martin Callanan had... No, he resigned at nearly a phase of the Morris McCabe
2014, but David Taylor then
David Taylor resigned subsequent to the report coming out there in early
and
November.
And both of them were on full pension.
Oh, yeah, they would be, That's the... Now, there was an issue came up later. Morris McCabe is involved in the legal action and there's an issue over the state, this was brought up in the Dáil, over the state covering the legal costs of Martin Callanan. There's a suggestion that... If this advances and if there's a payout, there may be an issue of the state going after him for some of the costs. But based on precedent, I'd say good luck to the state if they're doing that. But we've seen this before, Ray, a number of times. People walk away at the full pension and there seems to be no comeback, certainly in relation to any type of financial penalty in that regard.
David Taylor retired, not...
He retired, excuse me. Resigned. Once you've 30 years done, you can retire in the Gardaí, and he'd done the 30.
So then Drew Harris...
Yeah, the new commissioner.
He went out to visit Morris McCabe.
He did. After Judge Charlton's report was published, he went out to visit him. I think he stayed in a few hours. I think anybody who's been to the McCabe household, you always get a nice bit of grub there, like, you know. And I think Drew Harris was probably fed there. And it was reported at the time that he said to Morris McCabe he'd changed policing. And Drew Harris himself is in there because of the upheavals, most of which were due to... The whole thing that's... You see, the thing about it is this, Ray. Morris McCabe came along and the system was not ready for him. You had a system, the relationship between successive governments and the Gardaí, there was a problem there. And the problem was there was no real oversight from the government. If an issue came up in the upper echelons of the Gardaí, the government's general attitude was, look, live at it. And a lot of this goes back to the 70s at a time when there was a feeling in some quarters that the state may be under threat from paramilitaries. The Gardaí were the last block standing between that. And there were certain things that were let done loosely. That resulted in a series of scandals that came and went. You had the so-called heavy gang, the Kerry Babies, Donegal. It kept popping up. And then along comes this guy, late 2008, 2010 and that, and it pops up again and it comes into the political domain and the system wasn't capable of handling this.
But whistleblowers had come and gone.
Yeah.
But none of them were as dogged and determined as Morris McCabe.
Absolutely. And I suppose there's a few things feeding into that. There's quite obviously the character of the man himself. He was, and his wife, and I quoted this in the book, he was stubborn. I mean, at one stage they thought it was over and... When the internal report had been done, and you know, it looked like this is the end of the road. He's not going to, what he believes is going on is not going to come out. But as Lorraine, his wife, is quoting the book as saying, it was never over with Morris. As far as he was concerned, this thing has to be done. So it was his character. There was his wife and her character. And I think Lorraine McCabe, and I think this would have been obvious in Katie Hannon's documentary. You know, Lorraine is a woman of serious substance. I think to have somebody like that beside him, I think, was a massive help.
And it's hard not to be unmoved by, you put at the end of the book, just tell us what that is.
That's a submission that I think was in relation to legal cases that were pending. Lorraine was asked to make a statement, and I've quoted that statement there, and that statement, a large part of it is basically the effect the whole thing has had on
like
her and the family.
A victim impact statement.
Yeah, exactly. That would be a very good way of putting it. Yeah.
And the thing that strikes me is, like, he was so based in honesty, and he felt that every action he took was for the good of the Gardaí, because that's all he ever wanted to be, was a guard and a good guard.
Exactly. And there's a reference to that Judge Charlton. He made a point to saying, you have scenarios... No, I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said you have scenarios whereby people come forward and some of them want the limelight. And they might have a certain thing. He said Morris McCabe came forward because he wanted things done properly in the Gardaí. And I think that... But as you said, he wasn't the first one.
Mm.
But the system, circumstances, what have you, others went so far and they couldn't go any further. And I mentioned his wife, but also his family of origin. And his father had a history of going up against the system. And he's still going, Michael McCabe, back in the 70s, there were pollution in Loch Sheelan where he had a hotel. And he went up against very powerful agricultural interests at the time. His name was brought up in the Dáil and all. So he had all of that going for him with that as well.
And just as an aside, you're... Dad would have stayed in that hotel.
I discovered
is this. The Sheelan Shamrock.
The Sheelan Shamrock, yes. It's there no longer, unfortunately, because of the pollution. But when I was writing the book, I took a few days off from home. I went down home to stay with my mother, get a bit of peace and quiet and try and get something done. And I just showed her a bit of it about the Shiel and Shamrock. And immediately she said, God, she knew the name. She, my father loved a bit of fishing. She'd booked him into that hotel. He went off fishing for a couple of days. So back, that would have been back possibly in the 70s or so. So I just said in the thing, you know, it's quite possible there if Morris was helping out in the hotel, he could have served the old man his breakfast, like, you know.
And your dad as well influenced you in that he admired people who were willing to step aside, step out from the herd. And
I did, And I mean, I just dedicated the book to him because he 2016, he died the year before... Before it came
out. Oh, that's right. Yeah. And was there any point along the way where you thought, because oftentimes over the last decade or so, you were a lone voice and you were reporting in the Examiner at times.
Well, in the early stages, possibly. I lone voice, but I put it this way. There was little take up. I'd been writing about this stuff and there didn't seem to be that much take up of it. And when you're in a scenario like this, I was looking at this thing. To me, Morris McCabe looked like a very genuine character. I had evidence for everything I'd written. I had met people like Mary Lynch, the taxi driver who was involved in the case, who was viciously beaten up, and a real genuine person.
Just tell us that part of the story.
Mary Lynch was a taxi driver. One night she took a fare to Virginia in County Cavan. The guy didn't want to pay her. Then he attacks her, and in the most vicious way. It was frightening what she was subjected to. Anyway, he was let out the next day before Mary could even arrive in the Ballybor station to make a statement. Within a few months, he was down in Tipperary. He attempted to abduct a child. Thankfully, the child's father was alerted and stopped him. He was charged with that. In court, he got bail, but that court did not know that he was already out on bail for the Ballybor thing. And within 10 days, I think it was, he encountered a woman down in Limerick and he murdered her. He's currently doing life.
And where does Morris McCabe come into that?
Where Morris McCabe comes into it, Mary Lynch, I think it was, may have been Mary who first brought it to his attention, because he was very well regarded by a lot of people up in Cavan, and Mary heard about him. I think it might have been Mary brought it to his attention. But he then included that as one of the cases that should be investigated. But also, there was an attempt then after that, at one stage, to suggest that he had been the man who had let this guy out on bail. And he had to go away and prove that that wasn't the case at all. But
You were writing away on this.
Yeah, and I'd met Mary and could see that this is not somebody who's a beef against the guards or anything. At times, you know, you just feel, Christ, am I missing something here? Because nobody else seems to be following the thing. And then, purely by coincidence, I ran into Conor Brady, who's former editor of the Irish Times, former chairman of GSOC, the ombudsman. And I knew Conor vaguely. I think I'd interviewed him for the paper once. But he just happened to come over to me and he said, are you writing about that? Have you met this McCabe guy? And I was kind of noncommittal. And he said, oh, he's a serious man. He's somebody who should definitely be listened to. And I nearly felt like falling at his feet, because this was the first time somebody like him, who would know what he's about, who you obviously know doesn't have an agenda, who's somebody who has a background and he knows the guards or whatever. And when somebody like that was saying it, you said, I'm not crazy, there's something to this, all right. And purely by coincidence, two or three days after that, Conor Brady again happened to be on the This Week programme on Sunday here, and he said something similar. And I think that fed in a big way into public attitudes towards Morris McCabe when he came on and said that kind of thing about him.
And then various politicians began to pay attention to him. Claire Daly, Mick Wallace.
Very early on, Claire Daly and Mick Wallace, and John McGuinness, the chairman of the Public Accounts
Committee. He was instrumental in the Charlton Tribunal, because he gave evidence about that meeting with Martin Callanan in the car park of Bewley's Hotel.
Absolutely, very unorthodox meeting, very unusual. John McGuinness gave evidence of that Martin, this was after they'd heard from Martin Callanan at the Public Accounts Committee. The day after, he got a phone call from Mr. Callanan, met in the car park, inside in the car. He says, and it was totally accepted by Judge Charlton, Martin Callan told him that Morris McCabe had abused family members, that he was under investigation for child abuse, and that he'd wanted, that John McGuinness would want to be very careful how he goes with this whole thing. Yeah. And I think John McGuinness was pretty blown away by the whole thing, and his evidence, I think, was very crucial in the Charlton Tribunal.
And for a long time, the only moving pictures people saw of Maurice McCabe was him going into the PAC.
Right,
did he go to the wrong entrance the first time he came back?
He walked up along that news clip. He walked up looking for the entrance. He came back, and there was one of his colleagues, a guard at the gate, and he said, "'Tis in that way." And you just see him going through and walking across the
with
yard.
With the backpack on.
Into the PAC. Yeah. And he went in that day. He decided he was going to wear his uniform because he was going in, as far as he was concerned, he was going in as a guard, he was going to wear the uniform. He put on a jacket over it just so as not to, anybody would think he was making a display of it.
Okay, right.
But once he got inside in the room, he took off his jacket and he sat there and gave evidence as a Garda sergeant.
Very proud Garda sergeant. Now, in the book, and it's like and a lot of things that are intriguing, there's conversations between two people and then one person says, well, I said that. The other person says, you didn't say that, I said that. And the brilliant thing about Maurice McCabe was that at some stage through all of this, he decided to record conversations.
He did. He came to the conclusion... You go back to '06 and there was this allegation which really shook him. That was associated, it was the daughter of a colleague. There had been a history between him and the colleague. He had reported the colleague for ill discipline some months before this. It was investigated. Everybody who went near it, the investigating officer, the DPP, the chief state solicitor, representative in cabinet, all said, there's nothing to this. It's not credible. They literally said, you know, this is absolutely baseless. But the whole thing left him very shook. And then he began reporting these things and his trust, even in some colleagues, was very low, and he began recording conversations. And those conversations came back at various stages. There was an attempt to suggest he hadn't cooperated in an internal inquiry. He produced a tape recording to show that that hadn't been the case. There was a controversial recording he made with the confidential recipient, who was the man who would receive complaints from whistleblowers, that ended up in the Dáil, that was quoted by Mick Wallace in the Dáil, and there was others as well. And as you say, he was lucky. He was very lucky. Some people might look at that and say, it's a bit sneaky.
It's covert, yeah.
And there's a case to be made there. But in retrospect, when you see what the guy was up against and when you see what may have been done had he not had those recordings, you have to say it was certainly astute of him to do so.
And I've interviewed you before and I've read the book and I'm constantly amazed at his strength of character because everything was stacked against him. And then, you know, you're saying errors were made, Tusla and all that stuff. And then just how he kept going. And there was a time when he thought he couldn't go on anymore. He was admitted to John of God.
I mean, as you say, huge strength of character. Very fortunate in those around him, which was a huge thing. Yeah. But even at that, there were still occasions.
He was still alone in his head, if you know what I mean.
Still,
you know,
really dark occasions. Yeah. And at one point, he really thought he couldn't go on. Lorraine, his wife, drove him up to Dublin. He booked himself into John of God's. He spent, I think, a night or two there. In that time, though, he came to two conclusions, I think. One was that he was not, despite what was being borne down him, psychiatrically ill, and that it was something he was capable of
handling.
And then secondly, he also came to the conclusion that, in some ways, he was inside there. And was he hiding and leaving Lorraine, his wife, there to take the heat from the whole thing? So he came to a conclusion pretty quickly, no, he was going to get out and he was going to do what had to be done.
Yeah. We owe him a debt of gratitude as a country, don't we?
I think so.
How is this going to pan out now? You've obviously spoken to him since the documentary's gone out and since the report was published. So how is he now?
I think, particularly since he retired, he feels there's a weight off his shoulder. You know, he feels a certain freedom, I would think, because you're talking, going back to 08, what's that, over 10 years? So I would think he definitely feels a weight off his shoulder. I would say there's an element of sadness to it too, though, because, as you said, this is a guy who wanted to be a guard.
He slept on a board so he could reach the height.
Get the extra half inch. He was turned down initially because he was too small, so he slept on a board to get the extra half inch.
He made a citizen's arrest.
Yeah, he made a citizen's arrest when he was up shopping in Dublin with his mother and sister, chased after a guy. Yeah. And ironically, the guard who came on the scene then, a number of years later, he found himself in the same class as him, going for a sergeant's course, you know. But as you say,
he had ambitions, didn't he?
He, I mean, and look, before any of this arose, and this was subsequently shown, there was testimony when he was in Clonus, where he became a sergeant. The local district judge spoke from the bench when he was leaving. Colleagues there. The four superintendents that he served under in Ballyburgh up until 2006, 2007, the testimony there, they couldn't have spoken of him in higher terms. So he was definitely somebody of substance and he was definitely into the job. He had a huge vocational aspect, element to his job. And to leave it, I'd say it's a huge relief because of everything he's been through. But as well, you'd have to say there's probably some sadness there.
We can't be definite about anything in the future, but he will be compensated in some way.
Yeah, well, even this week now, there was a hearing in the High Court in relation to two of the cases he has, I think, against the state. And in both, the state has admitted liability. So it's an issue now that goes forward for assessment of damages. So he will be compensated, definitely. How you get back those years is another issue, but monetarily you don't.
Have you to go? Because we've loads of text.
No,
I tell you what, we'll take a break and then we'll go to Noakes. And Mick will stay with us just to react to your text because there's loads of them here.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
We're talking to Mick Clifford. Force for Justice is Mick's book, and the final verdict is the updated version of it since the Charlton Tribunal was finished in October. And, of course, Maurice McCabe retired from the Gardaí. Let's see what they're saying, Mick. Fascinating interview, says Anne. Please ask Mick Clifford if his book is available on audiobooks.
I think it's audio. No. It's certainly available in Kindle. I don't think it's audio.
The people of Ireland owe so much to Mick Clifford, John McGuinness, Claire Daly, Mick Wallace, TDs, for highlighting this, the case of Sergeant Maurice McCabe and retired Garda Wilson. In my opinion, these cases would be buried without the Michael Cliffords of this world, says Moira. And John Dillon was also writing about the pollution in Loch Sheelan in the Irish Times, says Kerry Listener. And let's not forget John McGuinness, or Kilkenny TD, who from day one believed Maurice McCabe. John, too, is one who continually looks for justice, says Anne. And tell Mick Clifford his book should be read by every Irish citizen. Aisling O'Callaghan, Cork. Remember Mick from UCC. That's Aisling O'Callaghan. And that story about Garda Maurice McCabe should be made into a film. It'd be hard to beat Katie Hannan's.
It would.
Maurice McCabe is certainly my person of the year. If there are any competitions next year looking for nominations for that title, I would certainly be nominating him. I also think Katie Hannan deserves great credit for her sensitive handling of the documentary. Mick also deserves great credit too, as he kept on the case and kept us well informed on the case, as Aina in Mullingar. And whistleblowers must always leave the organisation. That is borne out worldwide. What's he going to do with the rest of his life?
I don't know. He certainly won't sit at home. I'd say he might try and get involved in some kind of bit. He enjoys a bit of farming. I don't know whether there'd be a bit of that in his family too. And he'd do something along those lines. He's only retired there, 4 or 5 weeks ago. So I'd say he'll take it easy until the new year and then start looking to see where exactly, what direction he'll go in now.
I watched this story in its infancy when you broke it on Vincent Brown's Tonight Show, and I could see by your attitude that you believed in Morris's allegations, and while others teetered and doubted his character, what's the name of the book, please? So, A Force for Justice. And Morris needs to get the Scott Medal, first class. Whistleblowers need to be acknowledged for their bravery. In Morris's case, great bravery, John Morgan. And you asked the question, and other people asked the question in the book, like, what's the cost going to be on, you know, he has suffered so much.
Monetarily he'll be compensated, but he won't get those years. And remember, he's five children.
Yeah.
You know, the oldest, it takes about 24, 25. And the best years of growing up, and they were under serious strain, like, at times. You know, and Lorraine makes the point in that statement you referred to, that Morris is a real hands-on father, but at times he was so absent, she was left on her own. You know, it was a real tough time they had, you know.
And she makes the point as well, which people appreciate, that your partner is there, you know, to offload your problems on and for support. And he, because he had so much on his plate, he wasn't there for her.
Exactly, you know.
And the saddest thing ever was that there were loads of days when she feared he wouldn't come home.
Yeah, absolutely. And there was one incident in particular where he went off to meet somebody in the dead of night to help him out because he was being set up, basically. And I think he didn't bring his phone. Now, some people might call it paranoid, but when you look at the other things that are going on, he thought at one stage that perhaps his phone was being bugged or it was being tracked, so he didn't bring his phone, and Lorraine was worried he was gone, and she rang, and you can imagine the scenario. She's there in the kitchen, she rings him the phone, next thing his phone starts going off over there. No, he arrived back, and thankfully in meeting the colleague was able to help him, and right. It was real huge help. But there were nights like that didn't know where things were going to go.
Now, not everyone thinks he's a hero. He has removed all discretion or leniency from guards. Now we have zero tolerance.
I don't think that's true. The discretion, and this was brought up, became a subject of contention between Alan Shatter and Mick Wallace, but this idea of discretion. A guard stops you on the road. That guard has discretion and always, and thankfully, and will, and the vast majority of guards use that discretion correctly. The discretion that was at issue was... once that guard makes a decision that a particular scenario... he or she's used the discretion and decided still this person, something should be recorded in terms of speeding or whatever. Once it goes into the system, the discretion further up, it was having checks on that where a senior Garda can look at it and say either if there's a petition and someone has extra something to bring in their right and say, well, there was this circumstance or that, the Garda can make a decision. It's just having some check on that discretion at that level, that it's not there to be abused. And what he highlighted and endorsed, as it was by the likes of the Comptroller and Auditor General and the Garda Inspector, was at that upper level, that discretion was being utterly abused.
Yeah. It's mad to think that through all of this, that I know people have resigned, and two Ministers for Justice and two Garda Commissioners and General Secretary of the, what they call him, Secretary of the Department of Justice, Brian Purcell, yeah. But nobody was sanctioned as such.
No, that's quite correct. You know what I mean? Are we? And that's a much wider problem than the guards, right? Are we back?
I think in Ireland.
Yeah,
I think culpability
Yeah, absolutely, and consequences and that sort of thing. And if it ever does happen, it's those at the lowest rung of the ladder that they get. And this
scapegoated.
And it's been repeatedly said. Issues in the Gardaí, and you could say elsewhere in public sector, supervision is a huge issue, but once somebody gets to the level where they're a supervisor in any capacity, it's nearly to a large extent as if they're insulated from any responsibility of that which they're supposed to be supervising for.
Yeah. Alright, still highly recommend it, and it's in the sort of updated version, the final verdict of Force of Justice. Mick, thanks very much.
Thanks
happy
very
Christmas.
Much. Thank you. Many happy returns.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551. If you want to text us, child and adolescent psychotherapist Coleman Nochter joins us in studio to deal with any of your parenting issues. How are you doing, Coleman?
Good, thanks, Ray. And you?
Do you see more people over the Christmas period? Is it a stressful time for families?
Yeah, it is a stressful time, and you'd oftentimes stuff come to the surface over Christmas. So January's busier than prior to Christmas. I think people are kind of hectic getting ready for it, but putting all the families in the cabin fever situation of Christmas for 2 weeks tends to boil over.
So it brings issues to the fore, to the surface. Yeah.
I mean, our peak rates are always kind of March, April, May when exam season starts, September, October when school's back, January. Those are the three peaks in the year.
We said you were coming in, and we got a number of emails from people who want your advice. Dear Ray Coleman, my 15-year-old has some mental health issues. Dad left when she was young, and she suffers from depersonalization, derealization disorder. She's doing really well and is on a low dose of antidepressants and getting therapy, attending a psychiatric unit. We don't live in Ireland, so we got help within 24 hours of her getting ill. The thing is, she absolutely hates me. She can't stand me. How I eat, how I behave, how I talk, comments I make according to her, I'm always screaming, which I never do. By the time we get to school in the morning, she has criticised me 8 or 9 times. It is like character assassination. I prepare her breakfast, have slept in her bed with her, in my arms while she was sick. I cook, clean, work, etc. Everything is prepared for her and I spend time with her as much as she can stand. She's a good girl in school and otherwise in every way. I am like a lightning rod to her. She takes it all out of me. I'm starting to show symptoms of how I'm being treated. Of course, I should be the adult and I am, but there comes a point where a human, that's me, cannot live like this.
Yeah.
So just Depersonalization, derealization disorder. Yep. Tell us about that.
Depersonalization is where you have this feeling that you're outside of yourself. It's a dissociative disorder. So you get these experiences of almost like you're looking in from outside on things that are happening. And it can usually happen in times of high levels of anxiety. And derealization is almost like you feel your environment isn't real. So if you're familiar with the movie The Truman Show, it's yes. almost like that. Yeah. That's, is this kind of... is this a dream or reality? And again, kind of, they're perceptual dissociative disorders that would happen periodically.
It's scary stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're fairly serious diagnoses yeah. there. And thankfully, this girl is in treatment for those things, and she's on an antidepressant and attending a therapy clinic. The difficulty here is that this is common, and I'm afraid to say, in terms of parents, or mostly mothers, becoming the kind of, yeah, that sounding board for every frustration within my life. And this 15-year-old girl is going through way more than any 15-year-old should expect to be going through. These symptoms are serious, they're frustrating, they are debilitating from a lot of the, from points of view. And we do take it out on those who are close to us. And the other thing to understand here is these are perceptual disorders, so her perception of things is going to be distorted by the nature of her condition. So when she feels that her mum is screaming at her when her mum's not, that's just her truth. That's how she's seeing it. And when she's in that space, there isn't a dad on the scene here, so mum is going to get, is getting double dosed as the sounding board for this. And it is incredibly common that these relationships become really fractious and really difficult, escalating into physical stuff at times. And it's really hard to manage, because although this lady says, you know, I'm the adult here, adults still have feelings. You know, it doesn't mean that you can be this kind of robotic and absorb that sort of trauma, which
so
it
how,
is.
What advice would you give her?
I mean, I think the issue here is to try and mend that relationship as best as possible. And if they're in a service, there's some wonderful relationship counsellors and relationship therapists that can work through this stuff and help to allow this daughter to see her mum as something different. But also, and I, this might sound really critical, and I don't mean it to, but mum might be doing things that are irritating this girl unbeknownst to mum. And there's a belief that, and I hear parents saying this a lot, you know, I've done everything for her. I do this and I do that. And you list off the tasks. That doesn't guarantee a good relationship. And in a real unrealistic world, yeah, it should.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know,
I bought you this, I bought you that, yeah. I feed you, yeah, all that sort of thing.
And,
yeah.
You know, the roof over your head piece, 15-year-old and teenagers don't necessarily value that as something exceptional. They will when they're parents themselves, but at that moment, that doesn't really count for an awful lot. And
it's a given, in their
words. Yeah, and it's not a sense of entitlement or anything, it's just that that frame of the reference within their world doesn't include those things. And like, I've had parents say, look, I bring her to camogie matches, I collect her, I have a taxi, and then the child might say, would you never ask me how I feel?
Right.
You know, and so in the doing, the frantic doing, we tend to not ask how it's going. And it's about moving from doing to emotionalizing and almost trying to see it
it's
from
nearly,
her perspective.
You know, to use this word, the mindfulness parenting is to be in the moment sometimes. So not always hurrying here, there and everywhere and doing and doing and doing and just sitting and talking.
Just stopping and asking what it is that you can do. Yeah. In this situation where this seems like this child is perceiving everything her mum is doing is nagging, irritating. She's 15 years of age, and so her mum is going to be the most uncool person in the world, and everything that she's going to do is going to be wrong. That will change in time.
It will pass. Yeah. That's the reassuring thing.
Yeah, and it does. And they could do it some help. But I'd say for this lady herself, I would get her own therapy or support. And because she says, I'm starting to show symptoms of the way I'm being treated. And it is. This is hard stuff for any parent who's dealing with this. It's relentless and it's soul-destroying. And you do need somewhere to take your stuff and offload it.
That's good advice.
And that's certainly where I'd go first.
Right. Coleman, my wife is convinced that I have a problem with my phone addiction, that it's never out of my hand long enough to spend real time with the children. Personally, I think she's overstating it, and she's every bit as bad as I am. Anyhow, does Coleman have any advice to help, and that's in inverted commas, me spend better quality time with the kids and her?
Yeah, this is what we call cognitive dissonance, where if there's somebody worse than you, then you don't see the faults in yourself in some respects. So there's always another person who's
worse. Always is somebody worse and better than you, isn't there?
But from the point of view, of both these parents seem to be quite tech friendly in their use of their phones and things. And it is like, it is something we don't realise how much we do. And it's only when it's pointed out to us that we tend to realise, gosh, I it's not out of my hand. And from a parenting point of view, this is not to instill a whole raft of parenting guilt, but there is real issues out there where children, as I say to you, 5 years ago, I'd say all I heard was mum saying, I can't access my daughter because she's stuck behind a screen. All I hear now is teenagers saying, I can't access my mum because she's stuck behind a screen. And so we've taken this, if you can't beat them, join them approach to technology, where it's the first time that the young have taught the old and we're later to the curve. And we established this kind of really excuse that it's a work thing. And the reason I'm emailing over breakfast because I have to respond to this thing. And we can make all the excuses in the world, but from the point of view of self-regulation is really difficult. And this is the issue I take all the time. We could take all the creepy stuff off the internet. It wouldn't stop us playing Candy Crush for four hours. It's not always the inappropriate stuff that's the problem. It's actually regulating our own desire that's the problem.
You know, it's a really straightforward thing, and it's actually sad that I have to say this, but making eye contact with your children, like,
phenomenally important,
isn't it?
Absolutely. There's a beautiful saying, I think it was Winnicott says, you know, the mother holds the child in her gaze. So that connection is where you hold anxiety of the, or the worries of the other person. And the eyes are the windows to the soul. I firmly believe that. And the whole culture of selfies and all that is about the gaze of the other. It's so important. But if we have to fight to get that, the gaze of someone, then we're going to look to what behavior creates the look. And oftentimes it's misbehavior. If you're away on your phone, it's only when one of the children hits the other one that you look up.
To get the attention,
And you have to catch them being good. For this man, I would say very simply, sacred spaces. And I'd say this relentlessly. It's not going to the cinema, because that's where you switch it. You have to switch off your phone, but you're not connecting. Something like you do something together. And it's simple stuff. It's like building a fort with the cushions or a game of Scrabble. Yeah. We went to Santa last Saturday in the Jervis and got a Jenga thing.
Yeah.
We've got so much crack out of that Jenga.
We played headband at the weekend.
And it's those things. If you're not doing that stuff, you forget how good it is.
Yeah.
And it's just that lovely connected moment.
It's terrible that we have to advise people on that.
Oh, look, this is ridiculous. We have to prescribe people time to themselves. I was saying about mindfulness, and I'm a fan of mindfulness, but I don't think we could sell that in the 80s. It's because we live in this mindless society that this stuff has become prescriptively important.
Right, so get off your phone.
Sacred spaces.
Coleman, my 7-year-old daughter is constantly gyrating on chairs to get pleasure. I asked her why she did it, and she said she loves the feeling of her bum being massaged and tickled. She does it at every opportunity, the dinner table, library, and tries to go into the office to do her homework as the chair there is slightly bumpier. I asked if she did it in school, and she said yes, but the children on her desk ask her to stop as she's rocking the table and disturbing them. The teacher even asked her to take a drink of water after a stint, as her face was so red. It's extremely embarrassing. Any suggestions?
Yeah, the first thing, I mean, this is really common, unfortunately. Not unfortunately, but it is common, and people really have a difficulty. And this is...
What is it?
It's a sensory issue, right? And it freaks people out because of the connotations that there's something sexual. So that's just a socialization process. When children are 3 years of age and they're running around with their nappy over their head, we're all laughing and joking. But they did it in Tesco's when they're 7, we'd have an issue with it. So the behavior hasn't changed. The world has changed around them. So this is no longer
the expectation
acceptable
of their behavior. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have to socialize them. And this is really hard because you can't even Google this. Do you know what I mean? If you're sexualized behavior with children, you know, where do you go with this? There's all these kind of connotations to it. So people feel really lost, and parents really freak out by this, and they get really disturbed that, is this a sign of abuse, or is there something that's happened? Quite simply, children are kind of polymorphously stimulable. They can, get blankies and rub in the eyelids and all. They just find these things pleasurable, and sometimes genitalia is the source of that. At 7, she's just barely at the age of reason. She's prepubertal. So this isn't, and I think the worry is this is kind of a precocious onset of puberty or something. It's absolutely, I wouldn't imagine it's that at all. This is just something that she finds pleasurable, and she does it. And it's not sexualized from her point of view, it's sensory. So from the point of view, but the handling of it has to be so sensitive.
Yes.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Freud gets a lot of stick around the Oedipal phase and all that. Basically, the importance of this is when you introduce this stuff, you're introducing the concept of shame and disgust to a child. So you're basically saying you have something that you should be hiding and ashamed of. And the introduction of that is so important. You know what I mean? And you get this. If you touch that again, we're going to cut it off. And all those sorts of potentially traumatic type things.
You go blind.
Yeah, and it's about trying to introduce this in a way that it's a socialization. You need to do this in the privacy of your own space, and other people might misinterpret what you're doing as something else. You're not saying it's wrong, you're not saying you should be ashamed of it, but you should learn ways to privatize it, if that makes sense. That's not the right word.
So that's what they have to say to their daughter.
Yeah, this isn't about her feeling shameful of her body. It's not about her feeling
that
she has something
wrong. That's difficult to communicate, isn't it?
It's incredibly difficult because she's seven. Yeah. And she's not going to get the nuances that it's about. And she's just saying, you're saying there's something I'm doing which is wrong. And she's not necessarily misbehaving. You know what I mean? She's behaving in a way that the world doesn't accept.
Finds inappropriate, yeah.
And so it's really just trying to coach her through kind of that her body is something that's...
And she'll come out the other side.
Of course, yeah. And again, if this was rubbing your eyelids with a pillow or having some sort of a sensory thing that you liked or picking your nails or biting or anything, we wouldn't have half the connotation. It's because it's where it is that we create the problem around it. I wouldn't freak out about it. I would certainly not let her feel ashamed of it, but just trying to coach her really gently into maybe doing that less in front of other people.
And it's common.
Common, sort of, very, very common.
There's consolation very, very in common. That, isn't there?
But you don't have a lot of parents coming forward. This is a radio question because you want to be anonymous. You really are struggling with it. And it's not something you tell your pals about because you genuinely fear for how they'll view your child.
Yes, Okay, I hope that works out. Coleman, I have four children, age range 12 to 5. The problem is the older ones watch more grown-up cartoons on Cartoon Network. The younger ones want to do all the things the older ones are doing. But he gets distressed and acts out with hitting after seeing some of these cartoons like Teen Titans. Should he be watching them? It's hard to separate him from the rest of the herd. Any advice? This is obviously common in families with age ranges.
Yeah, and I think if Teen Titans is the extent of it, this is going to get worse because the 12 to 5, I mean, they're going to have, they're different ages, so they're different levels of understanding, especially if this 5-year-old is acting out the stuff that they're seeing. It just shows that they're impressionable and they're vulnerable, and we really do have to watch the content that children watch. There's no kind of definitive evidence that watching violence things makes us violent, but from the point of view of children mimic, and so they see that sort of stuff, they get involved in rough play and struggle with kind of what looks like tomfoolery, but then they start getting injuring each other and all that sort of stuff. But from the point of view of the 12-year-old watches 12-year-old stuff and the 5-year-old watches 5-year-old stuff, and this is where the Fortnite thing and all that comes into a cropper, because they say, oh, 5-year-old in class has Fortnite, but really it's their 13-year-old brother has it. But you're going to say to your mom that my 5-year-old mate has it. And from that point of view, and parents need to be much, much more clued in to what this stuff is, because they'll just follow them into the room. I've an 8, 6 and a 4, and the 4-year-old is mad to play the Wii the same as the 8-year-old does and gets frustrated when
he
can't.
So what do you do then?
You separate it and you parent them differently according to their ages. And no, it's a pain because it's much handier to send them all to bed at 7:30, 8 o'clock. But actually, in fact, they should have different bedtimes. They should allow them to have a little bit more independence, that there's a separateness between these three. And that's not favouritism, that's just tailoring your parenting to the age of your child.
In an ideal world.
I think that's possible, though.
Is it? Yeah.
And I think that the surveilling what they're doing stuff is, it's about kind of being alert.
I suppose
if
you have the luxury of a couple of televisions, you're sort of fine, you're sorted.
Yeah, man, and that's a first world answer to things, you know, in terms of rather than having them fight over one, we'll get them two. But and then it is a practical solution if you can afford it. Yeah, you know, from the point of view, it takes out the rows.
I'd say most
things,
people have two televisions now. I think I would think probably more five.
Yes.
more five, right.
But from the point of view, it's just about making sure that the 5-year-old isn't overexposed to stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess, as I said, the Teen Titans stuff wouldn't be, it'll be when they're watching over 18s
and
15s.
It's not age appropriate. That's really the bottom line, isn't it there?
Yeah, and it's labour intensive to have to watch this stuff. This is stuff we wouldn't have to watch before. Like, I was saying to someone before, like, I used to watch Bosco right till I was about 12. And not because I had some sort of developmental delay, but it's just that was all that was on. But from the point of view, that wasn't a worry mom had. But now, with 900 channels, we've a different challenge ahead of us.
Coleman, thanks very much. I hope you have a lovely, peaceful Christmas.
And you, Ray.
And thanks for everything. That's Coleman Nocter there. That's it from us. Mary Wilson's on the way. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday.
The Ray Darcy Show. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.